A creature never before known to man.
Vampire.
UFO sightings.
Sea monster.
Vanished without a trace.
Good evening, and welcome to Beyond the Fringe, a weekly podcast examining some of the world's greatest, strangest, and most baffling mysteries, and then trying to make some sense of it all. I don't want to take up a lot of time tonight by rattling off my resume as to what qualifies me to host a show on mysteries and the paranormal. In future episodes, I'll be happy to talk about my lifelong interest in all things strange, and I'll even share with you some of my own mysterious experiences as well. Suffice to say that I wouldn't start a paranormal podcast, make that a podcast about the paranormal, without knowing a great deal about the subject. That being said, why don't we just jump right into tonight's episode? I chose this topic for tonight's show for two reasons. One, because it's a great story. It is one of the most recognizable instances of a mysterious disappearance in the connected literature of the paranormal. You'll find it in anthologies stretching back almost 100 years. It also serves as, let's call it, a cautionary tale about assuming what we don't know in a story. So rather than try to explain that, let's just follow along with the story. I'm going to tell you the story as it's been recorded before, and then after the story, we'll kind of break it down and see how it stacks up against prevailing evidence. So anyway, without further ado, let's talk about the disappearance of David Lang. It was on a small farm just outside of Gallatin, Tennessee, where David Lang, a farmer, lived with his wife, Emily, and their two children, Sarah, age 10, and George, 6. September 23rd, 1880, was a crisp fall day, and David had just returned home from a trip to Nashville, where he had purchased seed for his crops, equipment for his farm, and toys for his children. As Sarah and George were playing with their new toys, David made his way across the pasture toward his horses to see how their new horseshoes were holding up. About that time, a horse-drawn carriage appeared around a bend in the road and was approaching the house. In the box seat was Judge August Peck, a respected member of the community and a close family friend of the Langs. At the reins was the judge's brother-in-law, Lucas. Upon seeing the judge's vehicle, David Lang patted the horse on the hind quarter and watched it trot away before turning and making his way back toward the house. And Emily rose from her seat on the porch, and she waved as she took the steps down from the porch to the driveway in order to greet her guests. David waved as well as he took perhaps 4 or 5 strides in the direction of the house, but there would never be another step. Before David Lang's boot touched the earth again, he would vanish into thin air. One moment he was there, the next he was gone. Emily screamed and raced toward the spot where she had last seen her husband. Judge Peck and his brother-in-law leaped from the carriage and rushed to meet Emily, who was closely followed by Sarah, George, and the housekeeper, Suki, who had been alerted by the screaming from outside the house and came out to investigate. When the group reached the spot, there was no trace of David. There were no trees or buildings to obscure their view, or behind which David Lang could have been hidden or had been hiding. It was an open field, after all. There were no wells, there were no gullies, no sinkholes into which he could have fallen. So the group began to fan out, and they scoured the field as Lucas ran to a nearby farm for help. Soon, friends and neighbors from across the Gallatin area joined in the search, and by nightfall, the local authorities had joined in as well. The fields were searched, farmhouses, any structure within 5 miles of the Lang farm was searched and searched again. But there was no sign of the missing man. Not a shred of clothing, not a drop of blood, not a footprint, nothing. David Lang had completely vanished off the face of the earth. An intensive search continued for more than a week. Local authorities even excavated the field for hundreds of feet in every direction from the spot from where the man disappeared, but nothing was ever found. After that, the authorities could think of nothing more to be done. The neighbors also began to return back to their farms where there was much work to be done for the coming winter. So the search was officially called off. But Emily refused to give up. Day after day, she would walk to the field, often alone, but occasionally accompanied by the children, and some days Suki would keep her company as well. Though Emily held on to what hope she could of finding her husband alive, Sarah and George, as well as the rest of Gallatin, were beginning to realize that David Lang would not be coming home. Unable to work the farm herself, Emily was forced to lease the fields to other farmers, which allowed the families to stay in the house and provided them a meager but livable income. Almost a year had passed before one day George and Sarah decided to venture out into the field where they had last seen their father. As they approached the spot where David Lang had vanished, they noticed a circular spot in the field, a patch perhaps 12 feet in diameter, where the grass was faded and brown and trampled, and it looked as though nothing else was growing there. George had picked up a grasshopper to play with and found it chirping on a nearby leaf, but when the insect jumped out of the child's hand and landed inside the circle, it immediately fell silent. It was only after the bug jumped out of the circle that it started chirping again. They found that strange, but what they found even more strange was the noise they heard after that. It was very faint, and they strained their ears and turned away from the wind to try to catch it again. And there it was. It was almost like a whisper. It grew slightly louder and more distinct, and soon they were able to make out a phrase, "Help me. Help me." It was then that they realized that the voice being uttered was a plea, and that the plea was coming from their father. The children rushed back to the house and burst into the kitchen where their mother and Suki were preparing dinner. Trembling, they breathlessly told their mother what they had heard out in the field. Dropping a bowl that shattered on the floor, Emily raced out of the house toward the field with Suki and the children right behind her. Upon reaching the spot, Emily held up her hand to command silence. She then heard it too, that faint, almost impossibly far away voice, but there it was. "Help me. Help me." As Suki and the children rushed to her side, the voice grew fainter and fainter still, before finally fading away altogether. Emily fell to her knees and began sobbing uncontrollably. It was the last time anyone would ever hear the voice in the field. Emily would never recover from the traumatic events that took her husband, and she died, some say, of a broken heart about 10 years later. Of George, little is known. Even Sarah lost contact with him after their parents had passed away, but it was rumored that he died fighting in the Spanish-American War around the turn of the century. Sarah was more fortunate. She grew into a beautiful young woman, married, and had 3 children of her own. However, the disappearance of her father always haunted Sarah. It was during the 1920s that Sarah, like millions of others, became involved in spiritualism, the fad of the day, which was a practice of attempting to contact spirits of the dead through seances. She consulted with several mediums and tried repeatedly to summon the spirit of her father, but without success. On the verge of giving up, Sarah decided to try one last time to see if she could reach her mother and father in the afterlife, and in the spring of 1928 attended her final seance. When it was Sarah's turn to seek the spirit's assistance, the medium began scribbling furiously on a notepad. This automatic writing, as it's known, continued, and the spiritualist's hand steadied a bit, and she began writing in long, arcing prose. Then the lights came up, and Sarah looked to see what had been written on the pad. The message read, "Together, now and forever, after many years, God bless you." But what was even more remarkable was that Sarah recognized the handwriting. It was that of her mother, Emily. Happy in the knowledge that her mother and father had been reunited in the afterlife, Sarah gave up spiritualism and lived a quiet, normal life. But in 1929, the writer Stuart Palmer was researching an article about the strange fate of David Lang and was able to track Sarah down in order to verify her story. Palmer interviewed Sarah, and she recounted the tale at length, going so far as to sign an affidavit, which was notarized as a testament to her veracity. Sarah lived another 36 years, passing away peacefully in her sleep in 1965 at the age of 87. And that, my friends, is the strange tale of the disappearance of David Lang. Like I said, this story became a bellwether of the true mystery genre that saw its heydays in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. Stuart Palmer, the writer who interviewed Sarah Lang, published his story in Fate magazine in July of 1953. Since then, it has been retold and told again, printed and reprinted in perhaps 100 collections of similar tales of mystery, even finding its way into the national media from time to time. It is the first story of more than one of 70 included in Frank Edwards' Stranger Than Science, which is one of the most popular books on the subject. It's a favorite of the paranormal set because there seems to be no explanation other than a supernatural one for David Lang having vanished into thin air. Theories have ranged from witchcraft to time warps to interdimensional doorways, micro-sized black holes, and of course to everybody's favorite go-to, alien abduction. And with all things being equal, as they say, one explanation is as good as another one, right? Well, there's one explanation that is suspiciously absent from many of these lists of probable causes into the disappearance of David Lang. One explanation that never seems to occur to those who read the story for the first time, and that explanation is that the disappearance of David Lang never happened. I know what you're thinking. Now, wait just a minute. We have all of these witnesses. We have Sarah Lang's sworn affidavit. We have Stuart Palmer's research and the research of scores of subsequent writers. Surely all of this evidence can't be made up, right? Oh, it can. And it was. To find out how the true story of David Lang's disappearance originated, we're going to have to go back almost as far as the purported tale itself. And while some of these leads might seem to some as skeptical as the story itself, they are traceable and for the most part verifiable. Now, the first mention of this motif, man disappears in an open field in front of witnesses, appears to come from a Joseph Mulholland or Mulhattan. Sources disagree on the spelling of the last name. And it's said that this Mulholland invented the story during what's known as a lying contest in the latter part of the 19th century. Now, these lying contests were a popular form of entertainment before the advent of radio, where contestants would vie to come up with the best tall tale. These contests are still being held to this day, as a matter of fact, with the world's biggest liar competition being held annually in Cumbria, England. Now, this reference is sketchy to say it the least, and it's not meant to serve as a rebuttal to the David Lang story. That'll come later. But it does show that the story, like all tall tales, has a genesis, and this may very well be it. Now, we know with a degree of certainty where the story started. But how did this obvious lie evolve into one of the greatest true mysteries of our modern age? Well, we have none other than Ambrose Gwinnett Bierce to thank for that. Well, who was Ambrose Bierce, you ask? Though not well remembered today, Ambrose Bierce was one of the most recognized, prolific, and respected writers in America in the late 1800s. A Civil War veteran, poet, and journalist, he was one of the first to foray into what has become known as realistic fiction. His book, The Devil's Dictionary, is considered by many a masterpiece of American literature. So what does Bierce have to do with the David Lang story? Well, that goes back to 1888, when Bierce was working as a newspaper writer at the San Francisco Examiner. On October 14th of that year, three articles appeared in the paper under the collective title line Wither, W-I-T-H-E-R, question mark. One article concerned a British runner who went missing during a road race. Another told of a young man who disappeared just outside the front door of his home and whose cries for help could be heard fading away into the sky above. And for those of you who are familiar with the story of Oliver Larch or Lurch, you'll find this very familiar as well. Now, the third article was entitled The Difficulty of Crossing a Field, which told of a plantation owner in Selma, Alabama, named Orion Williamson, who, in front of multiple witnesses, one being a, quote, Dr. Maximilian Hearn from Leipzig, unquote. Notice in this case, the high-ranking witness was a doctor, not a judge, as it was in the David Lang story. But Orion Williamson apparently vanished into thin air while walking on his property. 13 years later, these articles appeared in an anthology written by Bierce, and it was entitled, Can Such Things Be? So we have these appearing in a newspaper, and now they appear in a book called Can Such Things Be? So these two things alone kind of are ushering the reader into thinking like, well, these are true tales. These aren't made up. I mean, you have names, dates, places. I mean, this really happened. It was in the newspaper. It was in the book, right? Okay. Now, this book effectively launched the genre of true horror and mystery fiction, stories that were designed to make the reader believe that the tales actually happened. Before this, most writing of the type were tangential and they lacked focus. They were basically fairy tales. You know, they would follow the paradigm of, you know, there was once some guy in this place this one time. But Bierce had honed his craft as a newspaperman, and he imbued his stories with names, exact dates, and real locations that were verifiable and thus convinced his readers that they were reliving an event rather than reading fiction. His writing has been compared to that of Edgar Allan Poe and H.P. Lovecraft, and he influenced a score of well-known writers like Crane and Hemingway in the 20th century. So Bierce was not a hack. He was a good writer, and he knew his craft. Now, whether Bierce knew about or even had access to the Mulholland / Mulhattan original is unknown. And for all intents and purposes, it really doesn't matter. What we do know is that Bierce's articles and short stories containing the man crossing a field and disappears were in print and widely available at the time that Stuart Palmer enters the picture. Now, we remember Stuart Palmer as the one who interviewed Sarah Lang and got the affidavit swearing to the authenticity of the story. Now, Stuart Palmer was an author of books and screenplays, and he's best known for his character, Hildegard Withers, who was a Miss Marple-esque heroine in many of his mystery novels. And just as a side note, and mentioning this coincidence, that the three stories that Bierce wrote for the newspaper were under the collective title Wither, and Stuart Palmer's heroine that solved all of his crimes in his mystery novels was named Withers. So take that for what it's worth, I guess. But anyway, Palmer began his writing career in the late 20s and was a frequent contributor to Ghost Stories magazine, in which he serialized a novel called The Gargoyle's Throat. So he was no stranger to putting out these supposedly true tales of terror and horror and mystery. So after a successful career as a mystery writer, he continued by doing periodicals and often contributed to magazine of fantasy and science fiction and also to Fate magazine. And it was in the latter that on July 10th of 1953 that Stuart Palmer had published an article entitled The Mystery of David Lang. Now, this is the story that I recounted for you at the beginning of the podcast, almost verbatim. The names, the dates, the places, they're all there. Even the notarized affidavit signed by Sarah Lang was produced to ensure its authenticity. As such, The Mystery of David Lang has become and remains to this day one of the linchpins in the true mystery genre. It wasn't until after David Palmer's death in 1968 that questions about the article began to arise. One of the main concerns was that if Palmer had in fact interviewed Sarah Lang in 1929, as he had claimed, why had he waited 24 years before publishing the story in Fate magazine, of all places? That's when an unnamed but enterprising sleuth decided to have a look at the Sarah Lang affidavit. Upon closer examination, it turns out that Sarah's handwriting and the handwriting of the notary public, who were supposed to have verified the story, were both a spot-on match for the handwriting of none other than Stuart Palmer himself. Yeah, he faked the whole thing. And it took years for this ruse to be discovered. But by that time, it was too late. The story was already in wide circulation, and it made its way into as many as 100 books and magazines, all professing the factual nature of the David Lang mystery. Now, in 1976, Robert Forrest and Bob Richards decided it was time to put the tale of David Lang to rest once and for all. Now, they were contracted by the Fortean Times, which is a British magazine along the same lines as Fate in the United States. And the two Bobs traveled to Gallatin, Tennessee to find out once and for all if there was any kernel of truth to the Palmer story, to the David Lang mystery, or had he just made the whole thing up. So they went about interviewing newspaper writers. They went about interviewing television station managers as far away as Nashville. They talked to librarians, law enforcement officials, folklorists, just about anybody else that they could think of that might shed some light on the myth of the David Lang disappearance. Next, they'd started combing through census records. They went over tax deeds, tax receipts, land deeds, farm sale records, birth certificates, death certificates. They looked through every scrap of paper that they could find. And after an exhaustive search, the Bobs came to two inescapable conclusions. One, the farm where the disappearance was supposed to have occurred had never been owned by anyone named David Lang. At the time of the supposed disappearance in September of 1880, records show that the land was owned by the Frake family. And second of all, there never was any record of any David Lang ever having lived anywhere near Gallatin, Tennessee. The only record of a David Lang that they could find anywhere in the area was a newspaper clipping that mentioned a Captain David Lang of Florida who had been visiting family in the area. And this David Lang never disappeared. He just, left and went home to Florida. The long and the short of it, Palmer made it up. Okay, fine. Great. Good one. I say this because I don't blame Stuart Palmer as much for the proliferation of the David Lang story as much as I do the dozens, if not hundreds, of other writers who, exercising zero due diligence or attempting any kind of confirmation on the claims made in the story, they just cut and pasted the story of David Lang into their own books and articles and let the chips fall where they may. They just took it for the fact that it's a true story, and that's that. Now, that may seem strange in this day and age where, with the click of a mouse, we can instantly access billions of items of information in mere seconds. To think that it took someone 23 years after Palmer first published that story for somebody to come along and actually verify its authenticity seems strange, right? Well, you have to remember, in 1976, when the Bobs conducted their interview and their investigations, there wasn't a World Wide Web. There was no global database. There was nothing like we take for granted today. This hunt was conducted by two dedicated researchers utilizing old-school, hard-nosed detective work, talking to people face-to-face, going blind, watching miles of microfiche spool by, and reading the tiny faded print and handwritten documents, some almost 100 years old. Taking that into context, it's easy to see why no one bothered tracking down the veracity of Palmer's story. And I have to think that that's just what Stuart Palmer was banking on. Nobody was going to spend untold money to travel to Gallatin and go through jump through all the hoops that the Bobs did. So, yeah, I mean, he's covered, right? So nobody bothered to track it down for years, and thus the mythos of the David Lang mystery just went on and on. It grew legs and just took off. But as we see, after looking at all the evidence, it never happened. It was just a made-up story. It was just the creation of a tall tale told by a competitive liar, the faux factualized newspaper report of one of the premier horror writers of the 19th century, and a magazine article written by a mystery novelist. That's all it was. But I also want to say that I don't think that this should diminish the legend for what it is. Let me explain. While it's not a true mystery, when all is said and done, it is an entertaining and a well-written story. And it stood the test of time. If you've ever read it, and I think you'll agree, I mean, it's captivating. It draws you in, and you rack your brain for, like, how could this have happened? It's a great mystery story, but again, it's just a story. How it became a true story is in and of itself a fascinating tale. Now, I'm sure if you go to Barnes & Noble and peruse the bargain bins, or if you comb through the paranormal aisles at any used bookstore, you're going to find at least one anthology of true mysteries that contain the David Lang story. It's inevitable. And I guess that should just about wrap it up, right? Well, not quite. There are a couple of interesting coincidences related to the David Lang mystery that I want to share with you. Now, the first of these concerns the writer of the original newspaper article that contained the difficulty of crossing a field, and that was Ambrose Bierce. Now, in 1913, Ambrose Bierce decided that he wanted to revisit some of his old Civil War battle sites, and then he wanted to go west. So, at the age of 71, he decided to depart Washington, D.C., where he was living at the time. He traveled through Virginia and North Carolina by rail. Upon traveling through Tennessee, he actually went through Murfreesboro, which is very close to Gallatin, Tennessee, which is where the David Lang story originated. Don't know if that had anything to do with it, but it was kind of an interesting coincidence. But that's not the big coincidence. He went on to Shiloh, which is one of the battlegrounds that he fought at during the Civil War. And then from there, he went to New Orleans, stayed there for a few days. And then he began to head west and basically trace the Texas-Mexico border all the way up across Texas until he arrived in El Paso. Now, beyond that, Bierce's fate gets a little sketchy. He wrote of his intention to ride with Pancho Villa's army as an observer, and apparently he did this. He accompanied the Mexican army as far as Chihuahua, but there is where the trail goes cold. Bierce was never seen or heard from again. Now, rumors persist that he had somehow offended Pancho Villa and was subsequently lined up against the wall of a cemetery and shot. Others state that he crossed back into the United States, where he traveled to the Grand Canyon and committed suicide. And there is evidence that he had thought about this long and hard. He had written friends and acquaintances about this in letters and journals for years. And there's also a local legend in Marfa, Texas, about an elderly gringo being brought to the town hospital, delirious and suffering from pneumonia. Now, the men who dropped him off at the hospital, these are presumably some of Pancho Villa's men, told the doctor that the man was famous for writing a book with devil on the cover. This could perhaps be referring to the Devil's Dictionary. But eventually the man died of his illnesses and was buried in an unmarked grave in a nearby churchyard. Whatever actually happened to Ambrose Bierce will in all likelihood remain a mystery, but the fact that there is a disappearance and a real disappearance tied to the fictitious disappearance of the David Lang myth, I think is an interesting footnote to the story. But that's not the only coincidence that follows the story. The second is, I think, even greater. In 2002, a chamber opera musical was commissioned by the American Conservatory Theater for the Kronos Quartet, and this piece was first performed at Long Beach Opera's Terrace Theater. The piece was titled, get this, The Difficulty of Crossing a Field, and is based on a newspaper article written in 1888 by, you guessed it, Ambrose Bierce. The action follows closely along with the lines of the original story, wherein Orion Williamson, a plantation owner, disappears while he's walking across his field. Now, this in and of itself isn't what you might call a coincidence, but what is perhaps the granddaddy of all coincidences is that the score of the opera was written by the Pulitzer Prize-winning composer of The Little Match Girl Passion. Does anybody want to take a wild guess at the name of that composer? It was David Lang. Well, that's going to wrap it up for this week's podcast. I hope you enjoyed listening in as much as I enjoyed sharing the story with you. And I hope you'll tune in again for the next episode, where I'll be talking about another mysterious disappearance. And spoiler alert, that one actually happened. So don't forget to follow us on Twitter, follow us on Instagram. If you want to leave some feedback, please don't hesitate to drop us a line at podcastbtf@gmail.com. So until next time, this is Jay with Beyond the Fringe, and I'm asking you to keep it real.